So the next session's on sanctity of life, and Dr. Patrick's already sort of introduced the subject, and I'm sure he'll tell us more that we want to hear. Pardon? So sanctity of life for 45 minutes, a 5-minute break, and then traditional sexual ethics after that, after the break, then another session of questions and answers. So, all right.
Abortion, because I thought I'd got to get it in this morning session. So the first thing we should do is ask you whether there are particular bits of the argument about the pro-life bit that you need me to go through in a little more detail. I do have time to take you through the domino effect of Roe v. Wade, if that's the next thing. But are there any questions that have brewed in your minds during the lunch break? Yes.
Something I want to ask, but I don't know how to ask it.
Well, try. Loud and clear.
I think a lot of times we think that if we can just educate ourselves enough as Christians, we'll better be able to represent the Christian worldview and expose the fallacies of the non-Christian worldview, especially the secular worldview dominant our world today. But I wonder sometimes if the problem is not just a matter of winning the debate of reason, but winning the struggle of political power. And what brought that to my mind is something you said early on this morning about, you were quoting one of the chief justices, maybe not the chief justice, the dissenting justice in the Roe v. Wade decision said that this isn't justice, this is just the exercise of law and power.
Yeah.
And I think that's what I see going on in the country today over and over again. A good case in point is the whole LGBTQ agenda. They're not winning that by having better arguments, they're winning that by sheer political power.
And rhetoric. Yeah, I agree with you entirely that we've been sleeping on the sidelines, haven't we? And allowed them to make an immensely successful move. I mean, the rise of the homosexual movement has been an astonishing piece of organization. I mean, not only that they did it, but they said they were going to do it, and we didn't take them seriously. It is a really astonishing outcome. I think those of us in the medical profession have to bear some responsibility for this, because we were embarrassed and didn't want to say what we knew. If we had have done, it would have been a very different world. I often say that if I was allowed to do one reality show, it could change this whole issue completely. And the reality show would require putting a camera at the entrance to the emergency department in any large city on Saturday night, Sunday morning, and Sunday night, Monday morning, after midnight and up till about 4 o'clock, or even longer. Blur the faces and simply say what they're there for, and the world would be a different place. I remember a few years ago, I was asked to talk to the residents in one of the best high-level trauma programs in the world, but certainly in North America, in Denver. And that was because the guy running it was a Christian, and he'd been very supportive of what I did for some years. And he said, "I've been talking to my residents, and they're willing to take you on. Will you come?" He didn't give me any agenda as to what I would talk about. So I went, and about 40 of his residents came to dinner in his house, and his basement had been built with the idea that you could have 40 or 50 people down there and have a high school meeting or a student meeting or whatever. And I thought, well, I'm only going to be here once. Let's push the envelope a little bit and see what happens. I said, well, you're all doing high-level trauma, but you have to do a lot of ordinary emerge as well. Tell me, Have you had to do things for homosexual patients over the last few months that you haven't had to do for anyone else? What do you think the next thing that happened? The doctors. What did the residents do when that question was asked? Unexpectedly. They all started laughing. The sort of earthy doctor's laughs. I mean, some of our laughing is somewhat cynical, but and this was on the edge of that. But the things that you do as a resident in Emerge are, if they were on Will and Grace, they would change the whole nature of a show like that. Just the list of things that are pulled out of backsides on Saturday night and Sunday night is incredible. Including concrete. And you can think of getting... They'll put anything in there. So what they're actually doing is really extraordinary. And then one young woman blushed to the roots of her hair. And I said, yeah, sex disconjoined from committed love shortly becomes first boring and then perverted. I've only ever had one person say no to that. And that was at a Christian college, the professor of biology, and it took about 5 minutes for people to say, but he's having an affair. Otherwise, you can say that to any group of students, and they will agree. One-night stands are not something to be proud of. They're a description of just how far you've sunk and where you go next. So this young woman blushed to the roots of her hair and went out, but then she came back a little later. And later in the evening, she told me, you got to me, but I'm bisexual, but what you said was true. So their success has in part been achieved by keeping the debate going so fast that, as they said themselves, and they didn't publish this widely, but it's been published now, what we must do is make sure there's no general public discussion of what we actually do. And we, of course, were too, I guess, embarrassed to say anything, but we should have done. And we should have talked about the incredible spread of sexually transmitted disease. It is falling apart because you can't lie consistently indefinitely. A friend of mine in the Caribbean is a good example of what can happen. I met him when he was a resident. When I was just becoming alive, and I went to the same church that he went to, and he told me years later that I'd been essential to his surviving as a Christian. I had no idea of that. But to cut a long story short, he became the director of the HIV program for the whole of the English-speaking Caribbean. Christian guy. He kept a very careful, low profile and stuck to doing things as well as he was able and did a good job. I mean, the rates were lower there than in many places. And he comes to the end of his career, is about to retire, and he's going to get an award. But just before that happens, the government of Belize asks him to write a specialist opinion on whether homosexual activity carries economic costs and whether legalizing it would have economic ramifications for the government. So he wrote a perfectly straightforward, documented, it wasn't his opinion, it was all referenced. But it said, what is the truth? Yes, it does. It is an expensive way of living. And if you covenant to pay for the consequences of that living, it's going to cost. And the alphabet soup crowd lost the case. And the UN, which they control, was furious. So they went after Brendan, and they told the University of the West Indies what he did was indefensible and unacceptable, and if you don't fire him, we will stop all UN grants to the University of the West Indies. That's blackmail. But they did it. And the university caved. They fired him. He said, they told him, look, we know you've done nothing wrong, but we need the money. Your pension will be perfectly all right. And he thought about it. He said, I'm not departing with a solid reputation. that I was fired. He took it to court. Now, that's stupid for a single physician to take a university to court. Not a smart move. But he did it. And what happened next was extraordinary, because the case became widely known. And then the modern world kicked in a way that I could not imagine. But it had gone through the courts, and it was obvious that there was a fix being placed on the outcome. So Christians in Jamaica said, we need to support Brendan. And there's a place called Halfway Tree where they have regular, if you're going to have a, you know, a general march or procession of pro-life, whatever, gay pride, any of those things, that they meet at Halfway Tree. So they just use the media, not the general media, but the phone, YouTube and Twitter and that sort of thing, and said, if you can come on Sunday afternoon, and they gave the date, we're going to have a rally in support of Brendan Bain. Now, 3 million people live in Jamaica. Over 100,000 people came to that rally. That is incredible. The prime minister of the day, looking at the crowd, was heard to say to someone, we could not possibly get a crowd like this out. Churches canceled, they closed down their early morning service early, rented buses, and drove for 2 hours to get their congregation to that event. And Brendan became known all over the Caribbean, and everywhere he went, people asked him, how are you doing? We're praying for you. So now he's been given a public reputation, which he's having to think about how he uses it in the next little while. They took 5 years to publish the judgment. And in the end, they said the university abused their rights, and they made the university pay him a certain amount of compensation, but they didn't pick up all his costs. But his brothers and sisters around the world picked that up. But we are not alone. The problem is that our world is not very good at expressing itself. And so we need to start thinking about this. In the big difference between evangelical revival, say in the 18th century, and the next two centuries, is precisely that outcome. The 18th century revival and the Clapham sect was directly involved in the abolition of slavery, the end of child labor, the reform of the prisons, and the end of the repeal of the Corn Laws. These changed Britain. There's nothing equivalent in subsequent so-called evangelical revivals. In other words, we've lost depth because we've given up on the Christian mind. So what you're looking at is an unengaged Christian mind that was not willing to see what needs to be seen. Now, the data, some of the data has to be collected. Yes, you have a question immediately. Yes.
Where did they say that?
The Stonewall Declaration. If you follow it up, you'll find it there. Yes.
Do you think that the opioid epidemic is another symptom of this problem that you're talking about? The opioid epidemic?
I think the opioid's got much more to do with the loss of meaning than it has to do with anything else. To me, the striking event in that area is when my wife was running her refugee camps, antidepressants did not move. They were not depressed afterwards. They took what had happened, they shook themselves, and they started getting going again. Whereas we can't do that anymore. We've lost that bigger picture. And that's why I think the suicide rate is a measure of loss of meaning, loss of purpose. So sexuality has got out of hand because, it's built into that. And I think I'm going to have to back up now. This wasn't quite what I said I would do, but I think it's what I should do. How many of you have heard me talk about pre-evangelism using the four levels of happiness? Some of you have, yeah. But do you mind if I do it again? Because most people haven't. This is the most powerful tool that I've had put into my hands as pre-evangelism. And it focuses on what you're talking about. And the person who taught it to me was the guy I was talking to you about, Robert Spitzer, the Jesuit. And I met him, 30 years ago. And I heard him talk about the four levels of happiness using Greek categories. But I understood what he was saying. And afterwards, I said to him, Robert, that's an amazing way to approach it, but can I have your permission to turn it into an earthier version that ordinary people can understand? And he said, of course. Much to my delight, a few years later, I got a book through the post called The Four Levels of Happiness, which I hadn't ordered. And it was by another Jesuit called Oscar Luc Fabre. And when I opened it, it was dedicated to Robert Spitzer and myself. And the story was lovely. I mean, only in the Christian community could this kind of story happen, because it brought focus and the family and the Jesuits into the same page. That's quite an achievement. Because I had taught the four levels of happiness in my earthy version to a couple of physicians at the Focus on the Family Physicians Conference. And then they had gone back home to their Catholic church and taught their priest, who was Oscar Luc Fabre. And once he'd got it organized, he said, I'm going to teach this to every Catholic church within driving distance of where I live. And once a month, he goes and teaches it to another Catholic church. Because our way of presenting the gospel is a little out of date. Now, don't get me wrong, I'm not saying anything heretical. I'm just saying we haven't noticed what's happened to our cultural history, and we need to change. There is one sense in which our presentation of the gospel is much harder to do than it was for Christ. Now, here's the biblical illiteracy 101 again. What kind of gospel does Mark say Jesus came preaching? A gospel of what? Yes, but not initially. Matthew says that immediately. That's right. Now just think about that for a moment. A gospel of repentance. Jesus came to a society that had a clear understanding of what sin was. So you could start with sin. Objective moral truth was not in question. Now in the university, none of the students believe in objective moral truth. That would be an imposition. So sin is not a real category anymore. So your first task is to get them to the point where they see that it is a real category. And that's what the four levels of happiness do. The one thing that everybody wants to be is happy. But we have a very unsophisticated understanding of what happiness is. And as I say, I teach it in four levels. And I can't even remember Robert Spitzer's Greek names for each level, because I've never learned Greek, sadly. I wish I had. I could have done if I'd been better. Well, I was too young to know. I had the opportunity, and my parents were uneducated, so I went to a school where I could have done ancient languages and then done science quite easily, but I missed that opportunity. So I don't have Robert Spitzer's Greek categories, but my earthy ones are much easier to understand. Level one happiness is all that many students reach, and I call it animal happiness. Now, what are the happinesses we share with animals? Food, yes, and sex, yes. Very straightforward. And I mean, I have, as I said, a herd of 40 Hereford cattle who could push over any fence that I could build, but they don't. As long as they have food, water, a monthly salt lick, and a very occasional bull, there is no problem. The poor old bull is worn out servicing 40 cows, you know. He goes to market when he's done his job. But they're no problem. And they have sex in public with no problem either. We'll do that shortly. We're on the way. You'll see it in the park quite soon, and it won't be prosecuted. So both those happinesses, when they are abused, turn into unhappinesses. Now, there are no eating disorders in cows, except when we feed them stuff we shouldn't feed them, and then we can kill them. because they'll eat more than they can handle. It's one of the ways that farmers could get back at banks who've closed them down and thought they'd got their herd. They could leave their herd with enough food to kill them before the banks got round to being organized, and they did that. But under normal circumstances, animals can't do themselves a great deal of harm. You have horses that have to be prevented from eating too much, but that's because they're in very luxurious pastures, which are not being ridden a lot. That's a different matter. But by and large, they don't do that. And there are no sex disorders in animals either. But with us, that's quite different. The eating disorders, of course, are eating too much and eating too little. Basically, in both cases, of course, they amount to using food for something other than appetite. And it would be fixed to a very large degree if we went back to Jewish eating habits. Obesity would largely disappear if no one ate alone, and everyone, when they ate, had civilized conversation. Because everybody has a body weight regulating mechanism, it's just a bit offset in people who gain weight. That's almost invariably due to bad eating habits in the past. If you eat together and you've got a parent who's going to make you civilized, you're not going to get overweight. Especially if that's a family problem, a few very simple things like having smaller plates, no seconds, and starting with a large bowl of green material first, and you're halfway there immediately. But once you've driven that system over the top, it's a different matter. But anorexia, of course, is total. It's a dysphoria of image of yourself. And I pointed out yesterday that the genderists create a great problem. If we are to accept that you can choose your gender, then you can choose whether you're fat or thin. Which means that I have no right to interfere with a young woman who says I'm fat when she's actually dying of malnutrition. That's incoherent. So the context of these things, abusive patterns, self-abusive patterns of eating and patterns of sexual behavior lead to unhappiness. Now, the food I've explained to a degree, it's complex and there isn't time to go into it, but just to point out for those who don't have a weight problem, have you any idea what a 10 kilogram weight gain costs in terms of calories stored instead of burned? It's very little. It's 5 calories for every gram, that's all. So a kilogram a year weight gain is 15 calories a day, stored instead of burned. The mechanism is still there, but it's just offset by that much offset, and you've got a problem. I've been blessed with a perfect system. My weight hasn't changed since I was 26. We don't know how to put it back yet, but sex is much worse. And what I'm about to say is totally politically incorrect and also outrageous in this culture. So for a while, I was very, very shy of trying it out. Now, you always try outrageous ideas out on airplanes because best after the first hub on the way out. You know, the probability of meeting the guy next to you again is very close to zero, so it doesn't matter. And anyway, he doesn't know your name. So, and everybody's interested in happiness. So I probably have this conversation with every third person I sit next to on a plane. And I don't start the conversation. I sit in my seat, I pick up my book, and I say, Lord, if you want me to talk, start the conversation. And of course, people sit down and say, hello, what are you doing? And they always ask you what you do. And I say, well, it's a bit hard to describe. A lot of lecturing. We go halfway around the world most years. And they say, what do you talk about? They're bound to say that, aren't they? And then I say, ethics, culture, faith, and public policy. I say, that's a mouthful. I said, it's important we get it together if we're going to survive. And we get to happiness very quickly. And I say, everybody wants to be happy, but they're very naive about how it works. I mean, do you know that there are at least 4 levels to that? And they always say no. I say, are you interested? They always say yes. And I tell them right then, this is very dangerous. You can stop me any point and I won't go on. But they always go the whole way. So at this point, when I was thinking about this step, a student sat next to me. Well, this was unfair. I mean, he was no match for me in argument. So he didn't actually have the choice about talking about happiness. I easily maneuvered him that far. And then I said to him, well, if you're like my class, you're sleeping around. And the problem with sleeping around is that sex will shortly become boring and then perverted. And instead of the expected explosion of disagreement, there was silence. He was a fourth-year student. And he thought for a minute. He said, wow, I've never thought about it that way. But he was an honest guy. He said, perhaps you're right. He was from a good home, but by fourth year, he was down to one-night stands. It is down to. It really means you've reached the point where no woman with any sensibility will stand more than one night with you. It's not good news at all. And so I said, well, it's true. The only thing you can do is to go up a stage. He said, what do you mean? I said, well, now you have to find out what you're good for and good at and stop paying more attention to that so that this malbehavior gets pushed aside a little bit. That's what Socrates wanted to be wanted the university to be about. But I'm afraid this is bad news too, isn't it? Those of you who are within 5 years of university, answer the following question. Have you ever ended a day at university and gone home saying, I am wiser than I was this morning?
Nope.
No. No one has ever said yes to that. But that's what Socrates intended it to be. He would be appalled at what we do now. T.S. Eliot saw this coming. Where is the wisdom we have lost in knowledge? Where is the knowledge we have lost in information? Most of your deans are proud of the fact that you live in an information-rich environment. It's something to be ashamed of at one level, the way they use it. Information without knowledge is useless. Knowledge without wisdom is called a resident, and it can be very dangerous. When you're dying, you want a wise doctor. Just to use my own specialty as an example of how these things fit together. But wisdom now, we don't teach it in the university anymore. We do at Augustine College, because you're going to have quite a lot of Plato and Socrates and a lot of Jesus along the way. One of the joys of teaching a course in the history of ideas is that because it's Augustine College, after the first couple of years, the students discovered the way that I talk about the Sermon on the Mount, and they said, you need to do that every year. So I do. So there's 5 to 10 minutes of the lecture that every week that starts with the Sermon on the Mount, and it takes me 20 weeks to get through the Sermon on the Mount. And they never forget that, because it's not my words, it's Jesus' words, but what I managed to do is bring it to life for them. So, what should be happening? What should be happening is you should be finding out what you're good at and polishing those skills. Instead, we turn you into neurotics. Once we've had people in medical school for 6 weeks, we've already spent too much money on them to waste it. We shouldn't be evaluating them on short-term memory every 6 weeks, which just makes them chronically anxious. Because even if you won last week, you might lose next week. It's ridiculous. We know you're going to learn enough to be a half-decent physician in due course. If I had my way, I would change the whole evaluation system. When students arrived at medical school, I would give them a list of competencies that they had to achieve and a list of names alongside them of people who could sign them off on those competencies. And when they've got them, they get their MD. The three smartest medical students I've known, none of them needed to go to medical school for more than 6 weeks. They would have taught themselves after that. All three brilliant. One of them never went to a lecture in the medical school ever. He realized that it was a total waste of time taking information from one piece of paper to another without it stopping en route. He could take it from one piece of paper in a book and stop it en route appropriately himself. That's what he did. He has a personal chair at Georgetown, still researching at my age, late 70s, with $1 million worth of grants. He became head of nephrology, having never dialyzed a human being in his life, but he'd done lots of dogs. Same principle. The other two are both black. Brilliant in both cases. One in South Africa, could have any job he wanted. They tried to recruit him to London. He said, why would I do it in London? He's a pediatrician. He said, in Cape Town, I can be caring for patients. One has had a liver transplant, and the one in the next bed has got kwashiorkor. There's nowhere in the world where I can have that kind of medicine other than South Africa and have the abilities to treat it. I met him first when he was a medical student and in South Africa, and we were talking over a meal, and suddenly, in response to something I said, he quoted a whole page of Shakespeare, straight off. I haven't had that happen very often. And then I started talking about what he was reading, and I gave him a subscription to First Things, and he's never looked back. And I had the great pleasure a few years later, more than a few years, it took about 7 or 8 years to find a woman who could actually handle him, but he did find one, and eventually he got married. And we went to the wedding. I got to read the lesson, and then afterwards, it's one of those things that happens to me regularly now, and it's just beautiful. We found our seats at the reception, and then there was some negotiating going on opposite me, and in due course, another person was sitting opposite me, a younger man, and he turned out to be a young doctor working in a mission hospital on the edge of Zimbabwe. And I said, what was all that about? He said, well, I wanted to talk to you. And it was another one of those. He said, I heard you 10 years ago, you changed the way I think. The job I do now, I would never have done if I hadn't met you. I wanted to come and talk to you. And I want to make sure that every time you come to South Africa, you come and visit my mission hospital. That's lovely, isn't it? That's our world, and we need more of it. But in all three cases, well, no, two of the three cases, they know the truth, but only one of them believes it at the moment. Two of them are on the way. The last one is really a metaphor of what ambition can do to you. This brilliant man has had an empty life. And he's come back into our life. We were close friends when our children were small. We both came across the Atlantic at the same time to look at jobs at Harvard. My wife bought a house in Ottawa. And she was right, because Harvard is such an uncivilized university, I couldn't work there. They write their results in code for fear that someone else would publish. I told the dean, whom I knew, I couldn't work there, and he was not mad. He said, I know what you're talking about, I'm trying to change it, and you're right, with a small family, young family like yours, you're much better off in Ottawa, and you'll be fine there. I hope to get you here. Chris took the job he was offered, and I said to him, the only thing that's certain, if you take that job, is a divorce. He laughed, and he was divorced 2 years later, because they drive you at that level. Britton Chance in Philadelphia would famously say to his research assistants, are you married? And if they said yes, he'd say, get a lawyer. Nobody survived working for me in this position without getting a divorce. He was proud of it. I'm glad he never got a Nobel Prize. He thought he should have one. But that's the world that we live in. Chris, on the other hand, went off. He managed to get through, but he was divorced 2 years later. His wife had hardly seen him for 2 years. He married again later. And then we're at the stage where our friends are dying off. And my wife's strange psychological quirk is that when one of our friends dies, she'll go on the internet and look up a friend we haven't heard of for some years and see if they're still alive. It's an odd phenomenon. And she chose Chris a couple of years ago. And I said, well, I know where he is. Just go to Georgetown and put his name into the Department of Medicine. You'll find him, which she did. So she sent him an email. And much to our amazement, she got an answer almost immediately. And it read like this. It said, strange that you should email me now, because I've been thinking about you guys a lot in the last few months. I've had an absolutely horrendous 8 months, and you're the only people that have ever been in my life to whom I think I might even be able to talk about it. Can I come and visit you? Of course, he said, yes. He said, I've got to go and visit Juliet, who was a friend of my second daughter's, who in her 40s had just developed breast cancer, and she was in Vancouver. So he said, I'm going there for Christmas. Can I come and visit you between Christmas and New Year? Well, when he arrived, we learned his story. In the previous 8 months, his first wife had committed suicide. His second wife had left him. A son by the second marriage had attempted suicide and ended blind. His daughter, by the first marriage, had got breast cancer, and he'd been diagnosed with two complex metabolic disorders, which were going to be a struggle for the rest of his life, all in 8 months. He said, "What do you say?" And I said, "Well, more importantly, what can you say about that, given that you believe Darwin got it right?" And he was honest. He said, "Well, that means, of course, there's nobody to blame. That's just the way it is." I said, "But you don't actually believe that, do you?" He said, "It's very hard to believe that." And we had 2-3 days of talking at that level. And he went off with some books, and we visited with him later. He's still struggling because he's been in that position for a long while, but I'm sure God is at work on him. Meaning matters. And it will get to you in the end. The only question is when. And the art form in talking about happiness is pointing out this is so. That you're meant to go to university to develop an understanding of what it means to be human that will last you a lifetime. The university doesn't do that anymore. So we turn reasonably sane medical students into neurotic doctors. It's hardly a good move. We should get them trained in an appropriate rate that they can handle, and it shouldn't be fixed, and make them competent so they can do a decent job. So we turn the happiness, too, of finding out what you're good at into an unhappiness. Even in athletics, we're doing it, aren't we? Really athletic people then come across other athletic people, and they start taking drugs to be more athletic, and of course it destroys them. We have no means of using the skills God has given us until we give them back to him, or the society as a whole puts limits on us that keeps it in order to a degree. I mean, the change is striking. When I was at school, we used to play this strange English game called cricket, which is a game I happen to be quite good at, but the only thing you need to know, in baseball terms, you can be out caught, but the catchers can be as close as a yard from the bat on some cases, depending on the conditions, because the ball hits the ground, and it can turn at a right angle, be almost unhittable. And a very small deviation, and you can be out, but there's no umpire behind the catcher, in your terms, he's at the pitcher's end. So he has to make a judgment from 22 yards away. Now, everybody close to the bat knows you touched the ball, but he can't see any deviation, he can't hear anything, so he'll give you not out. But at school, what do you think we did? The honorable thing to do, you knew you'd touched the ball, so you stepped away from the wicket to indicate to the umpire that you were out. That was the honorable thing to do. If you didn't do it, of course, you got the reputation you deserved, and your punishment would be quite apparent in due course. Now, in international athletics, we call them professional fouls, don't we? You know, when in hockey you pull someone down who's almost certainly going to score, all you get is a penalty. You ought to get a goal and a penalty shot. But we don't do that. We're losing our way even at the level of honor in the playing of games. Games were used in the early 19th century to teach boys in particular how to behave honorably, to lose well. That's gone. So the only thing now is to go up another level, which is to happiness three. This is the happiness of doing things that are intrinsically worth doing. The best example is raising children. Now, Ty and Joy are in the middle of raising children. It is not pure continuous joy, but it is, if you're allowed to do it half decently, one of the most satisfying things you do in your life. Those of you who've just left home, do write home regularly and tell Mom how much you love her. Dad likes it too, but he doesn't need it quite as much as Mom. And you have no idea what you can do to us as parents. Just an example, when Sally stayed on in Africa running refugee camps, of course, as a guy, the first thing I did was shut every room I wasn't going to use, remove every ornament to a safe place where it didn't have to be dusted so that the house could be cleaned in about 20 minutes, and it was shipshape, so to speak, from my point of view, and I could function without too much fuss. But every morning, of course, I switched on the computer to see what my children were doing, if they had emailed me. And of course, computers tell you not only that they have emailed you, but what time they wrote it. And a few months before Sally came home from the DRC, Zaire as it was then, there was an email from my son, written in the early morning, 1:30. And it began, inauspiciously, saying, "I've just finished talking to a young woman who says she comes from a Christian home, but it's not like our home. So I just wanted to write and thank you and Mom for teaching us what righteousness is and setting us free to practice it." You can imagine what I did at that point, but I managed to get that through to his mother. There was no email at the time, but you could get it there through MAF. I think that email gave her the strength to carry on for another 2 months. That's happiness three. I mean, that's mission accomplished when, by the grace of God, when you get an email like that. You can do medicine in that way too, can't you? When you, those of us in medicine have all had the experience of being sucked into the care of a child beyond the call of duty, a patient. And if you're allowed to win against the odds, you remember that patient for the rest of your life, don't you? You don't get any more money for it. Indeed, if you get any money for it. And they remember you for the rest of your life. Yeah? I can remember in the days before we had intensive care units, staying beside the bed of a man with one other resident for 48 hours because he had a heart as jumpy as a kitten and the only thing we had was electricity. We shocked him about 40 times in less than 2 days, but he survived because he'd had a small impact right near the bundle. That was the reason. I once shocked him before he was unconscious, but he forgave me. He never forgot me in the rest of his life, and I will never forget him. That's happiness three. But it's a performance happiness. It's a need to be needed love. And that too comes to an end. We arrive naked, we leave naked. We arrive useless, and we leave useless, basically. That's the story. So we need to think about that. The only way out now is to go to happiness four. Now, if I get to this point, I say this is extremely dangerous. Do you want to go on? But they do. I can slip this into grand rounds. You know, doctors have to go to one set of rounds every week to keep their credentials up to date, in theory. And I get asked to do that every now and again, usually as a result of a Christian mole in the university. I love doing it in New York with all those wonderful Jewish physicians, largely unbelieving, but very good docs. And I know within a few minutes of starting this that they've already written down H1, H2, H3, H4, U1, U2, U3, U4, and they're filling in the blanks. There isn't a U4, but I didn't tell them that. And I get to this point and I say, well, I'm sorry, there is a happiness four, but I can't possibly teach it to you because it's politically incorrect to do so in a state-funded institution. Sorry. You know what's going to happen, yeah. They look up and they say, "You don't mean that, do you?" And I say, "I know, I'm perfectly honest. It's more than my life's worth to make the next step." And in the end, they say, "Look, you can't do this to us." And I say, "All right, well, if I've got a quorum, I'll do it. Raise your hand if you want happiness for. What would you do?" They raise your hands, yeah. In New York, 90% of the hands go up, and I can never resist saying, I'm glad the rest of you are Democrats, with a small d, of course. Because happiness for all doctors know about, directly or indirectly. It's part of the trade, so to speak, especially pediatrics. Because particularly children, when they die, they often have a lucid interval. And it's a privilege to be there if it happens, because God shows up. Now, one of my colleagues is a woman called Diane Comp. Have any of you heard of her? Well, here's a Christmas book for anybody who likes a really nice book. She was professor of pediatric oncology at Yale, and the book she wrote was called A Window on Heaven. Now, like me, she went off to university from a Christian home of the evangelical variety, and like me, despite listening to good preachers, the faith got sidelined effectively for quite a long while. ambition in my case, and some flirtation with Marxism. Soon got over that. Went to Russia. That was that. Well, Czechoslovakia, actually. She became an existentialist, which is a more serious problem. She believed that life had no ultimate meaning. So you do what gives you satisfaction. And she loved children. She's very smart and not very pretty, so she knew she was not going to get married. But foolishly, she ended up doing oncology. And some of those children die. Now, what does an existentialist say to a dying child? The only honest thing to say would be, this is absurd, I'm glad it's you and not me. But she never said that, for a while anyway. But her mother kept turning up at the back of her head saying, Diane, I didn't bring you up to behave like this. Those children love you and you love them, you should be there when they die. And of course, in the end, she gave in to her mother in the form of conscience, and God, being who he is, turned up on the first occasion. A little girl of 8, dying of leukemia. Normally we save them, but this one, no. So she was sitting there with mom and dad and the hospital chaplain, and she was fading away. And then just before she died, she woke up, just for a minute. She sat up in bed and she said, Mommy, can you see the angels? Can you hear their singing? It's beautiful. And she was gone, just like that. What would you do? Weep, it would be the obvious thing, you know. Parents, of course, turned out to be Christian, and it was a huge help with their bereavement. Hospital chaplain ran away. He'd only got psychology 101, and he hadn't covered this. She took 2 more children to come back to faith, and I won't spoil the book for you except to say she writes in, I think in the introduction, that as an arrogant Yale professor, God used a little guy with an IQ of 80 to nail the last nail into the coffin of my existentialism. And it's an absolutely beautiful story. If you do buy the book for a Christmas present, buy a packet of Kleenex too. You'll need it. But we all have happinessful stories, or we should have. The moments when grace comes into our lives, and we need to learn to tell them well. I mean, my time is virtually up, sadly, but I'm here in part today because of one happiness for story, and I'll close with that. One of the many factors playing into my life, bringing me back to spiritual life, was the patients. When I came back to the Caribbean, I still had some questions about severe malnutrition that I wanted to attack, but I needed a model. Well, there is malnutrition in our hospitals, and 30 years ago, the easiest one to find was cystic fibrosis. There's got to be somebody in this room who has a family member with cystic fibrosis. But 30 years ago, they were technically malnourished when they died. They didn't look like World Vision pictures. The pictures that World Vision uses are a very, very small subset. They usually crush your core. That's less than 0.5% of the malnutrition burden, but it makes a very pathetic picture, so they use it. And it's due to the quality of the diet. The commonest problem is due to quantity, inadequate amount. Anyway, I jumped through the hoops to get an experiment going because I needed volunteers. And they had to be old enough to give consent. So the first volunteer was a 15-year-old boy with a body mass of an 11-year-old. I mean, to talk about informed consent, you have to be a very sophisticated bioethicist. I mean, as he said, I'd do anything for some muscle. He was a farmer's son, he couldn't even lift a small bale. I said, Stephen, you haven't even heard exactly what I want to do to you before you've said yes. He said, I don't care what you want, I'll do it. What I wanted was, I had to feed him with a tube through his nose with a chronic cough. That meant I needed a month. I said, it could be 200 times that tube has to be replaced given your cough. He said, I don't care. He never complained. Halfway through the month, we'd become good friends. We both love Monty Python, so we could share Monty Python jokes. Very amazingly dry sense of humor for a Canadian. Anyway, about halfway through the month, on a Sunday, the nurses called and said, we've got so many admissions today. And Stephen's just coughed off his tube again. We're not going to put it back till 7 o'clock tonight, so if you want your protocol followed, you have to come and do it yourself. I said, fine. I drove into the hospital. And when I got to his bed, I was wearing a suit, and he said, "Oh, you've been to church?" I said, "Yes, do you go to church?" Turned out he was Catholic, I was Protestant, and I said no more. I'd been well trained in the highly liberal environments I'd lived in over the last few years. You don't talk about that. So I didn't say anything. I went home. But his amazing mother, who was going to lose three children to cystic fibrosis, the next week said to me, "You missed an opportunity on Sunday. You could have talked to Stephen about faith. You would do that very well." She had no evidence for that statement. All she knew was that Stephen had told her, "I go to church." And she knew I was articulate. And she put the two together and made six. I took no notice. But it failed for Stephen in the sense that we got a few hundred grams of tissue, not kilograms. But to cut a long story short, we put the first permanent feeding tube into a CF child 30 years ago. You go to any CF clinic now and you lift the shirts of the kids there, and about 20% of them will have a little button on the skin. We put the first one in. Stephen made it possible. And it has extended their life by about 5 or 6 years, and most importantly, has extended their functional life to within 6 weeks of death instead of 2 years. It's been very, very successful. Wonderful. Anyway, about 4 years afterwards, about this time of day or a bit earlier, I was called to go and see him, and when I got to his room, he was clearly dying. And he hadn't said anything for a couple of hours, because when you're dying with CO2 levels going up, you're not in pain, mild headache, but you don't want to be alone. Mom was there. But when I came in, he said, "Sit down, I want to talk to you." I said, "Stephen, I'm sorry, you're so sick, what can I do?" And he said, "It says in the Bible, if you ask anything in my name, I'll give it to you. I'm 19 and I'm dying and I don't want to. What do you say?" What would you do? What I wanted to do was get out of there as fast as possible, but that wasn't an option. He was a friend. I tried the professorial escape route, but he was up to that. I said, "Stephen, that's a difficult question. It will take a while." And I had a little wisp of a smile. And he said, "I have a little while." Both he and I knew that his life was measured in hours at that point. So I took a deep breath and started with the Apostles' Creed. And of course, he didn't help because he believed it. Every section he believed. The trouble was, it wasn't helping. He wasn't ready to die. So I was praying too, because I didn't know what to say. And that lovely short prayer, "Help," was answered. As so often in my case, the good Lord teases me every now and again. He has a great sense of humor. He popped into my head a woman called Annie Dillard. Any Annie Dillard readers here? Must be one or two, yeah. It turned out it was a footnote from Pilgrim at Tinker's Creek. And she says, "Oh yes, God will provide for all your needs. But do read the small print. He decides what your needs are, not you." And I knew what to say. I pointed out to Stephen that by this time, 4 years after the first experiment, there were children running out the ward who wouldn't have had the energy to walk. There were little boys who were managing to skate for a minute each week, which was very important to a little Canadian boy. It was working. And I said to him, "Stephen, I think God is saying something like this to you. Stephen, you have done all that I want you to do. You've made a contribution to the world, the size of which many people will never come anywhere close. It's time to come home. Both you and I know that unless there's a miracle, you will die in the next few hours. Can you also believe that because God is in that, that is an act of goodness and mercy, not an act of unkindness or vengeance?" His mother hadn't said a word the whole time. There was a very profound silence for a moment, and then he looked up and smiled, and I was never more grateful for a smile. And he said, "Thank you, that helps. I think I can." And he died peacefully a few hours later. But his amazing mother had not finished with me. She wrote me a letter which I'd lost for years, and it popped out of a book about 2 months ago. It began, "It was ironic you were not allowed to give Stephen food for his body, but thank God you were there when he needed food for his soul." He'd been asking his priest, his doctor, his family. Everybody had pushed it away until I turned up. Now, it didn't matter for Stephen, did it? I mean, he was in paradise within 3 hours. He believed the Apostles' Creed. He believed that Jesus was the Son of God who came to die for his sins. He confessed his sins. He didn't have any fears in that direction. But for his mother and me, it was very important. It was very important for his mother that her first child die well, because she was going to go through this three times. I met her years later, and she said, if God had told me what he wanted me to do, I would have said it wasn't possible, but it was. It's all right. But for me, it was a guilt trip, because I hadn't had a conversation like that for 20 years. And I had to repent. And I did. And it changed my life. You've all got things to witness, too. The ones that are best are your failures. Just like my failure to witness at all for 20 years is genuine, real. There's an element of confession in it. That's good. Don't think you're called to help people with problems you have never struggled with. Other people are around who've struggled. You should make the connections and you should deal with your problem. It's called hypocrisy. And there's lots of need for a Hypocrites Anonymous in church, isn't there? The one thing God takes from us is our sins. They belong to him and not to you. Let him use them. It won't be comfortable, but it will be good. Now, we didn't get to where I was supposed to get to, sexuality. So I will leave you with one thing to do. You'll find it quite hard to handle, especially the young. But there's an absolutely magnificent talk by a woman called Janet Smith. It's called Contraception, Why Not? She's a brilliant teacher. It's so good, there's over 500,000 copies circulating. Just put Contraception, Why Not? Janet Smith into Google, you'll get there. And then I suggest you listen to it in couples, if you can manage it, at least with boys and girls present. And particularly if there are people contemplating marriage, very important, very good for them. Have a nice dessert and coffee beforehand and then enjoy watching their faces. Janet has been saying for years something that I've said, only not so sophisticatedly as hers, that there are ways to prevent divorce. And she has four rules. I had only one, but there are four in her list. The one you all know, you must not marry an unbeliever, and three others, which I'll leave you to discover. But I'll say one thing about the last one, and that is about using natural family planning. About 15 years ago or more, I became convinced that the Catholics were right on this. Because logically, it's not possible to say to God, I want you to be in charge of all my life, and then add, except my fertility, is it? That's not a logical statement. I'm logical. I don't want him to be in charge of all my life. All my life except my fertility, that would be all right. And he'll accept that. But you cannot think that you've entered into the whole of his will if you won't trust him with your fertility. Now, you can be as prudent with natural family planning as with the pill, because you forget to take the pill sometimes as well, so it has a failure rate. Natural family planning doesn't, actually, in the sense of technical failure. But if you use it, you're quite likely to have a baby in the first 2 years, but it will never be a surprise baby. You will know within minutes when the conception occurred. It goes something like this. Those of you who've been married remember this. How long did the bloom remain on the rose, so to speak? How long before you started fighting? Oh, we had our first argument of a fairly vigorous variety on the way to the hotel. But then we love arguing. My wife said to me, I'm married for the arguments, it's fun. As long as I let her win every now and again, you know. But nevertheless, it is true that we didn't use the pill because I wouldn't let Sally use it, because I looked at the dosage when it first came out and said, that is insane, it's going to kill someone. And of course it did. There was a male pill too, by the way. The guys said they thought their testicles were a bit small. Only thought, not measured. And they canned the whole project. A few women died, so they changed the dose. If that isn't sexism, I don't know what it is. But it's dominated the world ever since. But natural family planning is very different. The first thing you have to do is learn about one another. And Christian women, young women, fall apart laughing when they realize what the problems of their boyfriends are. Because if you ask a bunch of Christian women, how often do you lust after a man? They won't answer. They go all coy on you, you know. You can get past it sometimes. I say, well, how often do your friends lust after a man, you know? And they might say once or twice a month. And then when you talk a bit more, what they're really doing is saying, will you make a half-decent husband and a half-decent father? That's what women actually want. That's what they're wired up for. Men are not like that. A peak hormone flow, they can lust every 30 microseconds. I mean, that's the way it is. I remember in Jamaica, we had one female technician who was that wonderful 90% black, 5% Asian, and a little bit of European. And every time she walked down the lab, all work ceased. You know, she was totally innocent, a lovely girl. She had no idea what she was doing. She was just so physically beautiful that no guy could take his eyes off her. That's the way it is with guys. So remember, that's not easy to handle. But the first thing that the two sides have to realize is men have one hormone. So we're very simple creatures. Women, you look at their hormones, they look roughly like the Rocky Mountains. They don't know what they're going to feel like till they're awake in the morning. So you can always tell a natural family planning guy because he comes home with flowers when he's done nothing wrong. It's just that time of the month when that's a very smart move. Now, I didn't sort this out in my own mind until two of my children were married and they were using technical approaches to their fertility. But the last two didn't. Now, one has 9 children, the other has 5. But they're not complaining. And their marriages are better. Both Sally and I recognize that. We're envious at that level. The first thing, who do you think is most affected by natural family planning, the man or the woman? No, it's the man. Because we didn't conceive of the fact that every day could be different. We get up, we're on the same clothes, drive the same route, come back home the same way. You know, we're very boring. They're not. What I notice in my son and son-in-law is how much more gentle they are with their wives. Because they're aware of what happens to their psyche throughout the month. And the wives, my goodness, they love those husbands. My son loves teasing me because he knows I've never had a birthday card like what he gets. Because every year he doesn't get a card, he gets a letter and a card. The last one began, "My Prince." Well, that thought has never crossed my wife's head in respect to me. It's been a joy to watch. And it's also been a joy to see what has happened. When I started talking about this on the CMDA circuit, I thought my time of speaking to evangelicals was going to be very short. And in fact, it started here in Blacksburg. After the massacre. And Ty and Joy, some of the earliest victims, but they don't complain. It leads to better marriages. And it does lead to more children. I mean, my daughter with 9 children, the house is permanently on the edge of total entropy. But it's full of love, totally full of love. I mean, and people tell me, you know, when Nicola and Tim come with their 9 children, they're less trouble than a spoilt single brat. Because, of course, they've had to learn to help. When you've got 9 children, one every year, or every couple of years, you have got to help, and they do. It's a delight to watch. So there I have to stop, and I'm late. Sorry.
That was great. And I think I was going to propose, so first I'll challenge your designation of me as obsessive compulsive, because I clearly would have developed a nervous tick throughout this conference. So, and I haven't. So I wanted to kind of, I believe that we kind of covered a lot of the topics we thought we were going to hear about. And I wanted to know what you thought, Dr. Patrick, and the registrants or attendees, you all, each of you, what would you like the last hour to be? This section coming up is the last official lecture. At the banquet tonight, Dr. Patrick will be talking about Augustine College. But as far as preparing for the university, this is kind of the last time we'll have where we've designated that for talking about that. So. Jenny's coming on at 3:00, and that is in 50 minutes. So I was going to propose a break and then come back and either have a longer question and answer period or a suggested topic. What would you all like to do? Okay, so he prefers questions. I'm going to just go with that. Why don't we take a 5-minute break, get some more coffee, come back and be ready with any questions you might have. And then at 3 o'clock, we'll have the Skype session with a previous Augustine College student, Jenny, gonna be talking to us. And we can ask her questions as well. Is there anything else I should say? Okay, thank you.